And so it was like, immediately I knew I wanted to do something different. I wanted to build something for my kids and my grandkids. And real estate was the most obvious choice because I loved it so much as like a, just as a product, not even an asset class. Like I just enjoy, like I'm your worst case scenario. Like I'm the guy that's like touring like open houses just to like see them. Not, you know.
Wondering what it takes to succeed in business? Welcome to the Hustle Podcast, where we share genuine stories of success and failure to guide you on your journey to achieving your goals. All right. So we are back with another episode of the Hustle Podcast, and I'm actually really excited. Michael Miller has been actually one of our clients in actually a transaction about a couple months ago. We've never met in person, to be honest with you, which is kind of funny how real estate works, where you can handle everything over the phone, on the computer. Welcome to the 21st century.
That's great.
But I know that from following you for a while, and then also mutual connections, Good Pasture, Joshua Johnson, and just other like-minded individuals in our area. You're really well known in Reading for just investing, real estate investing. And so I thought it'd be really cool as you can journey in real estate. It can be so many different variations. And I thought it'd be really cool just to hear your perspective because you can do it a million ways. So for the listeners that don't know who you are, kind of don't know your background, maybe start with how you got into real estate, investing, what's kind of your, you know, background? Because to be honest with you, I don't actually don't know the full story either. So
that's great.
I know. I'm going to listen intently.
Yes. Well, it's awesome. And it's amazing. It's funny because I think I found you on social media.
Yeah.
Same thing. And it's like we're in the same town and like,
totally.
It's like crazy. But yeah, I mean, I'm basically a recovered banker. I mean, that was my background. I grew up in banking. I started when I was 18 years old. And I've always kind of dabbled in real estate. Like I've always loved, I've had a passion for it. Like, well, you know, my wife's watching The Bachelorette. I'm like doom scrolling Zillow, you know, like that's, so I've always known that there was like a part of real estate that was a passion of mine and that I liked, you know, and I kind of, I say hobbyist investor, like I didn't have like an active strategy. I've just kind of bought and sold along the way and done a little rehab, done the house hack thing, like, you know, kind of throughout the years, but gosh, in like kind of COVID era, you know, I was just really starting to like consider making a big change. And I remember where I was sitting in my house, I woke up one morning and I literally like a light bulb went off and I was like, I love what I'm doing. And I think a lot of people in the investor space, they're like trying to get out of their job and like trying to, that wasn't my story at all. I loved, like the bank was so good to me. But like, it was literally like, I've got to build. And it was around the time my daughter was born. And so it was like, naturally, I think my like whole headspace shifted into this like legacy thing. And so it was like, immediately I knew I wanted to do something different. I wanted to build something for my kids and my grandkids. And real estate was the most obvious choice because I loved it so much as like a, just as a product, not even an asset class. Like I just enjoy, like I'm your worst case scenario. Like I'm the guy that's like touring like open houses just to like see them.
I'm not interested, but seriously, I'm not interested.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyways, it was like literally like 6 months later, I was out of the bank. I took a small detour, like kind of a stepping stone into a tech company I did some consulting for a little bit while I was kind of building out and figuring out what I wanted to do and how it was going to work, and got into a bunch of masterminds and got around a bunch of really smart people. And, you know, about 6 months later, we, you know, like went all in, and I think we bought $10 million in real estate that first year.
Wow.
And so like when I say I went all in, like for me, I went all in.
Yeah. And was that mainly like single family residence?
Mostly single family, small multifamily. I think my biggest unit right now is 10.
Okay.
So like, I don't have any big apartment buildings. I'd love to get into that. I think there's going to be opportunity for that.
Yeah.
But I really have a strong belief in the sustainability and the future of single and small multifamily, just from an economic standpoint. I really, you know, leaned heavily into that.
So with starting with $10 million in real estate, everybody always wants to start like, how do I finance that? So did you already have a primary property? How did you leverage it? And did probably your banking skills give you some creative financing for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So admittedly, I had a little bit of my own cash. And the worst thing that I did, ironically, in the whole journey is like, as soon as I decided we were going all in on this, I went out and I bought a bunch of land and I paid cash for it. I used my own money and like very quickly realized that I had made a major mistake. Like it was my first big mistake. Now I'm going to be fine. You know, construction costs went through the roof. I can't develop them. Like it was like in that whole era. And so now I'm sitting on a bunch of dirt that doesn't cash cash flow and yeah. all of my cash is gone. So like, this is my point of going like, wait a minute, I'm going all in on real estate. I thought I was going to do this. I blew all of my cash on this and now it doesn't pencil. So I knew I had to figure out another way. And yeah, my banking background, I think helped. I think it helps me understand like how the money functions, how the leverage works.
Right.
But it didn't help me know how to finance creatively. I didn't know anything about raising capital. I didn't even know what a hard money lender was.
Right.
And so I kind of dove into some masterminds because I literally was like, I got to get with people who have been doing this. And I got into some masterminds and started networking and started learning. And one of the first things that I learned was a guy named Pace Morby showed up at one of my events and started talking about subject two, and I'm a banker. And so immediately I'm listening to this and I'm like, this is for sure illegal.
Yeah.
Like that was my first thought.
So you're a fraud.
Yeah. Like this is you're, yeah, exactly. You're going to jail for this. And that was like January, like 5th or 6th, I remember. And I got to interact with him a little bit, ask some questions, and I was super intrigued. And for the next 3 weeks, I consumed like every piece of information I could on sub two and was like, holy smokes. Like, not only is this legal, but it's a great solution for people. And it requires basically none of my own money if I do it right.
Right.
And like literally like a week after that, I bought my first sub two deal. So like I went from this is illegal to owning a sub two deal.
Sir, we'll try it now.
Yeah, exactly. And then I bought 20 more like the following 6 months. And so that was a big creative strategy that kicked it off. And then from there, I moved heavily into capital raising.
And for those who are listening, because I could explain it, obviously being on my real estate side, for your subject to for somebody who's listening who does not know.
Super simple. Subject to is the process of buying something subject to the existing mortgage. So I don't need a credit check. I don't need bank statements or W-2 or tax returns. And in many cases, I don't need a tremendous amount of capital. It's not a perfect solution for every type of deal, but it is a solution for certain types of deals. And what it benefits me is that I'm able to go out in a 7-8% interest rate environment and take over a 3% interest loan. And I don't even have to apply or get approved for it. So the big misconception I think for a lot of people is I used to say this, maybe you've said it, is, you know, you go, hey, do you own your home? And it's like, well, the bank owns my home. What they mean is I've got a mortgage.
Yeah.
But legally, that's not true. There's actually two separate documents on a home. One is the deed, the ownership document. The other is the deed of trust or the mortgage. And so subject to, very simply, is the process of changing the deed, the ownership of the property. You can do that unlimited times, subject to the deed of trust or the existing mortgage.
Right. And for a while when the interest rates were really high, I will say they are a little bit better now, sort of ish.
I love how that we're all excited suddenly about 6.5.
We're very excited about 6.5. For the subject to, for somebody who's listening, for what I, and to be frank, being on the real estate side, typically it's that the seller has to sell no matter what. Like we've had tons of subject to offers and deals and strategies and everything like that. And it's either the person needs the funds to get it to, you know, or get their debt to income out. And then they just, it's a divorce sale. It's like, you know, has to be sold. What type of people do you most commonly find that are open to subjects to? Is it more that just stress sales?
I mean, certainly that's the low hanging fruit, pre-foreclosure, rapid sale, divorce. But I've also seen a lot of other situations where it makes sense, where it's like the way that I always say it, and we teach a lot of real estate investors, the way that we teach them is that every transaction has three motivations: time, or speed, convenience, and price. Every real estate transaction that's ever happened, retail or investor or anything in the middle, has one of these three components. The seller gets to choose one, sometimes two, but never three. And what I mean by that is that in a subject to transaction, they're often either stuck on a price that they can't get because the market's not giving it to them, and they're willing to trade their convenience of having that mortgage taken out of their name to achieve the price that they're looking for. And there's a lot of reasons why they might be stuck on their price. Sometimes it's that they're legitimately just like underwater in the house.
Right.
Like for me as an investor, the thing that a lot of people get like really worried about, because in investor world, we're typically buying like as cheap as possible.
Right.
I'll buy a subject to deal over current value sometimes, because what I'm getting is terms that make that deal cash flow for me in a way that I couldn't do in any other type of sale.
Yeah.
And the seller's getting their price. So now it's not a wrestle of one lever of price, it's truly a win-win scenario. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of reasons, you know, you could go down the list, but distressed sellers are often the most common that we see. But I've seen people that are relocating and they just don't want the headache of going to market. Mm-hmm. I've seen people that have fallen in love with their dream home and they're just like, I want to move fast. I can close a sub two deal in 3 days, mm-hmm. You know, or about as fast as escrow can, you know, handle it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons and, you know, it gets a bad name because there's some bad actors out there that take advantage of people and don't fully educate their sellers on what's entailed and all of that. And I've made mistakes in the process, you know, it was a new thing to me. I told you, I went from this is illegal to my first deal in a month.
To we bought land, to we're not cash flowing, to now we can find cash flow. Yeah,
like we move fast. And fast makes mistakes. And so, you know, but by and large, the people that get out there and say, it's the worst thing ever, and it's bad for the seller, and they're actually just don't understand.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience.
Yeah. If I was like a seller listening, I guess one of the most common questions we get on the real estate side is, what if you default? Like, what if you don't pay? Like, then it's like, there is pros to the seller obviously getting out of that situation because you took over, they move on to their dream property or whatever. But if I'm a seller, you know, for example, we have, you know, one of the clients this past year who had a divorce sale and she just didn't feel comfortable knowing who was going to be moving in. What if, like, you know, her divorce, you know, somebody like yourself defaults on the property, now goes back to it. Those are obviously the risks that run with subject to in terms of who's coming in, taking over. Do you find that there's a way to articulate that assurance, or is it just kind of?
Well, I think that it's what's more important than articulating the insurance is making sure that the buyer, the subject to buyer, is educated in handling the process properly.
Yeah.
Because if I always tell my sellers, if I default, which by the way has never happened.
Yeah.
If I default, that's actually the best case scenario for you.
Yeah.
Because in most cases, I've done something to improve the property.
Right.
I've been paying down the mortgage. I've stabilized it with a renter. And at the end of the day, if I default, you're getting a property back in a better situation than when you gave it to me to begin with.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing to consider. The second thing to consider is that if you're concerned about the default process and still being, you know, having to go through because a subject to seller can foreclose on me just like a bank can. Mm-hmm. But what we offer is what's called a performance deed or a deed in lieu of foreclosure. So we basically say upfront, if we default, you don't have to go to court and fight me for this property. We will literally just deed it back to you and you can go back to square one, if that's what you choose to do.
Yeah.
Again, there's very few scenarios where I've seen that even happen. And so it's a lot of times it becomes the boogeyman of possibilities when, to your point, most sellers are in a situation where they can't get a truly better outcome. And so this is the most viable option.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. I think it was going for a while when properties were sitting. I mean, we were getting a lot of subject to.
Oh, I'm sure.
All the time.
That's all basis.
It was tons of subject to, and it was just navigating it. You know, for some people, I think maybe one or two of my sellers sort of started considering it. But it really came down, and maybe it's just an ignorance in my zone is just like the debt to income, because then it's just like the seller doesn't have enough funds to move to the next property, or the debt to income is still counts against for them because the mortgage is still, you know, on their name. So that's always something I'm always telling sellers. I'm like, hey, this is a potential option, but you always have to know like where that debt to, and a lot of times for the one seller that was really considering it, it was that it was a rental property. It was like, they didn't even live here anymore. It was just an investment. Like they were just kind of done managing it as a rental, but still kind of wanted to hold it, but wanted a higher value. And so they had looked into like the subject too, but it didn't work out for them.
The three big breakdowns on sub two, and apparently this is your sub two episode, which is great.
Thank you guys for listening in. This is the awesome. Hustle.
No, I love it. It's great. Sub two's changed my entire life. And so it's not my only investment strategy, but I probably added $3 million in asset value to my portfolio utilizing the strategy. Right. So I love it. the three big boogeymen are what you just said. What if I default? Mm-hmm. Second one is debt to income ratio, which, by the way, like basic underwriting, if you talk to any competent loan officer, they will tell you that basic underwriting says that if I can provide evidence that I am not responsible for the payments, then an underwriter will remove that from the debt to income calculation.
Right.
At worst, they will treat it like a rental and give you 75% of that. So in a subject to transaction, that what sellers have to understand is they no longer own the home. Mm-hmm. And so they're not responsible for it legally in any way, with the exception of the fact that their name is still on that loan, which is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, no doubt there's a big deal. And so we can talk through all the security of that. But the point is that the debt to income ratio becomes a non-issue when you understand how to navigate the underwriting component of it. Mm-hmm. So we've had that happen with sellers where we literally had to do the sub two deal contingent on their ability to get financing for the next place. Mm-hmm. The debt to income thing has not been a problem for any one of my sellers far.
Yeah, because you've had a lot of experience.
You know? Well, and a lot of experience, but like I said, I've been doing them for a couple of years. So like, call me in 10 years and I'll see if anybody had bigger problems, right? Like, we'll see. I'm not, you know, Pace goes out there and makes these big, bold statements and I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to make that level of commitment. Yeah. But like those two. And then the third one is a due on sale clause, mm-hmm. Which is the big, if you Google sub two, that's the biggest boogeyman. And it's basically every or most conventional mortgages have a clause that says that if the deed transfers and the mortgage isn't paid off or liquidated, that the bank has the right to call the loan or accelerate the loan due on sale. Mm. The important language there is that they have the right. They're infinitely rare because, despite popular belief, banks don't want to own homes. Mm-hmm. They're very happy to have the paper.
Yeah.
It's like less than, I don't know if this is verifiable, but I've been told that it's less than 1% of sub two transactions.
Well, and they get the interest payment for like so many years before they even, like, you even pay any towards principal. So it's like,
exactly. It's a win. And in the events that, and by the way, I did have a due on sale clause. So I have had firsthand experience with that. They're much scarier sounding than they are. We resolved it and we kept the loan. Mm-hmm. And so they're resolvable. And so those are the three like big like seller considerations or concerns. Mm-hmm. And all of them come down to education.
Yeah.
And so like, this is what I mean when I go, though, there's a lot of bad actors out there. Because if I tell you, you're never going to have a problem buying another home, and I took over your VA loan sub two, and you don't have enough VA credits to go get another VA loan, I've absolutely screwed you out of your ability to go buy again.
Yeah.
And so you have to, there is an element of like, you got to know what you know. And having, you know, we joke in our space because realtors are a big, big, big win for me, like a huge center of influence, but they're also a lot of times the barrier to entry, because if they don't understand sub two, they're not advocating for
it. They're like, no, we're good.
Yeah, we're good. Like, I'll go get it on market. They have no interest in that.
Right.
And the point is like having good advocacy, I think, no matter how you're going to sell the property, is really important, which is why I'm not real estate agent investor.
Yeah.
Because I believe that the seller should have advocacy.
Yeah. You know? And options, and see which one lands the most. So how many subject to properties do you roughly have?
Like in the 20s.
Do you have any
single family?
Okay, all single families. And then prior to starting the episode, we talked about how many relative doors you have, which is probably around 60.
Somewhere around 60, yeah.
Okay. And it's always fascinating to me, like, that people will invest outside of the state. Obviously, your prices can vary. You can get higher rents, variables like that. What pushed you outside of the state and take that risk? Because I feel like knowing that market, or trying to mastermind and get linked up with somebody who knows that market and trusts you to be able to advocate and advise you where to even invest, is a huge leap, especially if you don't know the area. So I guess, starting out, with the areas outside of our area, Shasta County, did you know the area? Had you visited, or is it kind of just like the dollar made sense?
Yeah. So the stuff we have in Washington was easy because I'm from Washington originally. So that was kind of a no-brainer. And the biggest asset that we have there is a lake house that's an Airbnb, and it happens to be next door to my mother and father-in-law. So like, it's one of those, like, it wasn't even a good investment deal.
Yeah.
Like, it was just a deal that we made investable because we wanted it.
Yeah.
But as far as the other markets, like Ohio and Michigan in specific, because those are the bigger concentrations, for me, you're absolutely right. Like, I would not be in those markets if I didn't have boots on the ground. Brown that I trusted. Mm-hmm. And so the way that I got into those markets, I knew that I would break into new markets. I just didn't fully know how.
Yeah.
And the way that I did it is I, you know, had some of my students that I was teaching that had been with me for over a year now, kind of learning the investment strategy from me, they popped up and they're like, I've got these opportunities. What if we partner on them? Mm. And so I started breaking into these markets by partnering with students that I knew and trusted.
Ohio and Michigan was not on your radar.
It was not on my radar. Well, that's half not true.
Yeah.
Because Ohio, Indiana, some of these other places that have high cash flow mm-hmm. were of interest to me.
Yeah. But it was just, how do I get in?
How do I break in? And I've always said, and I've learned this a little bit the hard way, because we bought a couple of random things mm-hmm. thinking that we were just, because I honestly, like I said, when I got in, I'm like, I was on a real estate grab.
Yeah.
If I could buy it, I bought it. And so yeah. we bought a bunch of little stuff like that I ended up exiting about as quick as I got into them, because I realized that if I'm going to go into a new market, I have to be committed to 10 or 20 units there mm-hmm. because the cost of efficiency when there's one unit is mm-hmm. way too high. Mm-hmm. And so, but if I got 10 units there, handymen are easier. Property managers yeah. are all that stuff is easier. So that's one of the ways that I analyze a new market is would I go or analyze a deal in a new market is would I buy 20 more of these? Mm. And not only would I, but like, am I prepared to deploy the strategy and the capital to make that happen?
Right.
And so Ohio's done really well for us. We've got, you know, that's the smaller of the two. We've probably got like, you know, 10 units there. Mm-hmm. But I'm currently looking at our first big commercial. It's like a 65 unit apartment building. And then this random little town in it's called Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. It's on the border of wow. Canada. It is like a market that I would never have gone into is producing the most insane cash flow. Like it's kind of wow. sickening. I'll give you one example. I bought a 8-unit apartment building there, super distressed. There's a lot of economic things going on. They got a big government project for 15 years. So a bunch of people mm-hmm. are relocating to work, but I bought this 8-unit apartment building for $230,000, I think. Seller finance, zero down, 3% interest. I had to put 50 grand, I think, into it to get it like all up and running. And it's producing $12,000 a month net cash flow.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah. Like, so I look at that. Yeah. So I look at that deal and I'm like, now, obviously that's like the unicorn.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like the holy grail.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like not pretending like that.
That's like every 60 deals you have or doors you have.
Right. But the point is it's like, I don't even care if it appreciates.
Yeah.
Like that thing's going to be paid off in 2 years.
Totally.
And like, I just don't care. So that's kind of for me, the like out of state strategy has been like a little organic, mm-hmm. But it's been connected to people that I know, like, and trust, and specifically people that I trained. Mm-hmm. I've taken some knocks. We tried to do a couple of flips up there and I realized very quickly, like, it's not a flipping market.
Yeah.
It's great for cash flow. It's bad for flips. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I lost a little bit on a couple of flips, but that cash flow and that deal makes me feel better about it.
Yeah. It sounds like you like to hold more than flip.
And if there were some magic way I could not need money ever again, I would never flip or wholesale or turn a property ever again.
Yeah.
I only do it because I have to earn income to sustain our business and
right.
life. And because I have so much pent up depreciation that I yeah. have to like write off income. So I literally have to earn money.
Yeah. You're like, we need to do something.
Yes, exactly.
So out of curiosity, for the creative financing, you have seller financing, you have the subject to, how many loans roughly do you actually have in your name?
Like in my personal name?
Yeah. Like, or like, you know, for the subject to, you took over their existing mortgage.
Oh, you know, that's a great question, man. You're asking all the, like, I should know these things.
I know.
So like I
gave Michael no prep on this podcast.
It's awesome. So. I love it. So the only loan that I have in my personal name is my principal residence here in Reading.
Okay.
So I have, you know, and it's probably like $300,000 or something. Like that's literally my yeah. only like personal mortgage. I have in the business name, right, which is not yeah. in my name, probably. So we have about our total portfolio is somewhere around $12 million right now. Our total debt on it is somewhere in the ballpark of $7 million. And if I had to guess, I would bet that 4 of that is like some sort of investor capital, like mm-hmm. private money or DSCR or whatever. Yeah. And the rest of it is, like sub 2 like take like the assumption or seller finance.
Gotcha.
So
interesting.
Yeah. That's so like I use, and this is
leverage, or you leverage other.
I'm a big debt guy. I love it. I'm like the anti Dave Ramsey.
I was like, Dave Ramsey listens to this podcast now.
Yeah, exactly. I did get to talk to Dave's daughter once about this because I was and she hit me on, I think it was TikTok, and it was a pretty funny exchange. But like the truth, I mean, it really is the truth. Like I just believe that debt, and for me, my passion, we're here talking about real estate. Mm-hmm. My passion is really about helping people learn how to do money different. Mm-hmm. And because of my background in banking and what I've learned, I like realized when it wasn't until I got out of it that I realized that like the rules and the system is rigged against us. Mm-hmm. And real estate just happens to be the greatest vehicle for breaking out of that, you know, old way of doing money, at least in my opinion. But like debt, for example, people have to understand that debt is how money is created. Mm-hmm. Like in our system economically, debt is the creation of money. Mm-hmm. And so why wouldn't I just go borrow as much of it as I possibly can? Responsibly.
Well, yeah.
All those things. Yeah. But like, if I'm buying assets with it and I'm leveraging myself all the way up, and everybody's going to get on this and go, well, you know, you're going to, what if it crashes and what if this, and they're going to say all those things. Like, I get it, but you're not informed. Mm-hmm. Like you have to understand that real estate in particular is the only asset class that I know of that the equity can come and the equity can go, but the cash keeps flowing.
Yeah.
And so
it's a fixed.
And if I can get fixed debt now, this is where, you know, you can pivot to the commercial. And the reason why I haven't bought any of the big commercial mm-hmm. yet is because I think it's going to get squeezed because the debt isn't fixed long term. Mm-hmm. But in the short term, this is partially why I love the single family space, because I can get 30-year money, hedge my money against the dollar. If the rates come down, I refinance. If the rates go up, then somebody else takes the loss.
Right.
It's the greatest wealth building tool of our life for sure.
And is that it, referencing off of your hat, the Dead Presidents Club, is that kind of like what inspired like your kind of mentorship and everything like that? I mean, Dead President, I mean, that's a pretty like bold statement.
It's really bad timing considering the recent news. But actually one of the guys in our community.
No president has died, but assassination
attempts are not a good day. I literally posted that. Not a good day to have a club.
Saw that. I was like, oh man.
One of the guys in our community did these mugs of that photo of Trump. Doing the thing, and he whatever, he etched it or whatever you call it.
Dead Presidents Club.
But the not Dead Presidents Club. So Dead Presidents was just a tongue-in-cheek, like Dead Presidents is a slang for money.
Yeah.
And so for us, like it was a tongue-in-cheek way to go like, I want to build community with people who are just here for the conversation. Mm-hmm. There's no right or wrong or perfect way to make this work. But in my experience, one of the things people are the most afraid of, the most ashamed of, the most like insecure about is their money. Mm-hmm. And so the Dead Presidents Club was just kind of this like irreverent way to go like, let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
And if we can learn a little bit along the way and figure out that money's not that scary, that, you know, your financial situation is really not your fault because nobody taught you to do it, right? Mm-hmm. You're just figuring it out.
Right.
And, you know, we're all in this together. And so that was what the Dead Presidents Club. So it's a free online community that we have. We do like weekly calls and I'll have to bring you sometime. Weekly calls and training, and we have a real estate emphasis, but it's really more about figuring out how to do money different
and how to talk about money and just work on it. Because I think, you know, for the last couple of people that we've interviewed on our podcast, it's like we've talked to, you know, financial planners and everything like that. And it's just, I think, like you said, money, it's funny is like, if you were to say how much is in your bank account, everybody just like becomes like this. I mean, one, yes, it is a private financial thing, but at the same time, it's also a very pride thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, people attach their, you know, pride to their money and like their accomplishments and everything like that. But it is also something like, hey, if you want to move the needle, you want to invest, you want to change your life. It's like, you have to be okay with talking about your debt and how do you create solutions, you know? Well,
and we have to rip shame off of the whole thing because we're the only, I get that it's private for people and people that are private, that's fine. But I've always joked that I wish that we all just walked around with a big net worth like calculator, like running dial, because I think it would actually dismantle shame. Just a quick little example. I have a friend who's exiting a company, mm-hmm. And he's getting a $46 million payday. out of this company. It was like massive exit. And he literally called me and was like telling me about this deal and the parameters, and they're in escrow. And I'm like, holy crap, man. Like, you know, he's asking me questions. I literally told him, I'm like, I don't have that much money. I don't know how to help you, but like, you should probably call some smart people.
Yeah.
And he said this to me, and it was so interesting. He goes, I go, how are you feeling? Like, this must be a big, like, is this exciting? Is this, you know, and he goes, I'm so afraid because I don't know what to do because my bank account was overdrawn yesterday. Mm. Like, this is a guy who has a $46 million check coming in, and now it's proverbial, right? Like, it's not like he's really tapped out and has no money. But the point is it's like, people don't understand, like, that we're comparing ourselves to a narrative that we think is true. Mm-hmm. But if we could actually just expose what's really going on, we might all learn from each other.
Yeah.
Because like, you could look at me and I go like, yeah, I'm a multimillionaire, but like, I don't got $1 million in the bank. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't imagine you do. And you know, and like,
Sam likes me too much.
Yeah, literally. As you know, and that's another great point is like, Uncle Sam likes me too much, but like, Uncle Sam isn't the enemy. If we learn the rules, I don't pay taxes because real estate affords me, you know what I mean? And I go,
it's different ways to leverage it.
Nobody is saying this openly and honestly.
Yeah.
Like, it's literally just been recently that I've started hearing people go, yeah, like, I paid $200,000. I had another guy, I paid $250,000 in taxes last year. Oh. And I'm like, I want to throw up.
Yeah.
But I go, thank God that you shared that with me, because now we can talk about what I'm doing and we can talk about what you're doing, and we can compare notes. And so there is an element of the conversation that I think is just super healthy. And it's just, let's get shame off the table. Mm-hmm. Let's recognize that, like, whether you're in a great financial spot or a bad financial spot, you didn't get here on your own.
Right.
Like, somebody taught you or didn't teach you this.
Something.
So yes, your finances are your responsibility, but no, they're not your fault.
Yeah.
You got to make it good, but take the shame off of I screwed up or I didn't know, and just go dig in and learn. And that's what I'm really, real estate is awesome because I love it. But
it's like the actual tangible asset, but the passion behind
is like, guys, it's just not that scary.
Yeah.
And yes, it's hard, but so is being broke. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's hard, but like, yes, it's hard to work. And like, I got stressed because, by the way, that's the other thing people will say in the comments when they hear how much debt I have. Like, yeah, I lose sleep sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, I raise capital from grandmas and like, you know, like, that matters to me.
Yeah.
And yes, it's hard, but like, so is a 9 to 5 for 60 years.
Yeah.
And so it's like, we choose our hard, and we, you know, and I just want to create more conversations around it, I guess is the point.
No, I think it's great. I think before wrapping up the episode, for somebody listening, how do you, see a good deal? Like, what's the sling
real estate deal?
Yeah. Like, investors are always like, oh, it's not a good deal. What's a good deal to you?
This is especially, poignant considering you sent me 3 this week.
So I'm trying to update my CRM.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. No, I love it. Listen, I love it. I want every deal you've got. And again, like, all the guys that we have mutual friends who just make fun of me when I tell you this because they think it's impossible, but I'm telling you, I do it all day, every day. So, for me, if I'm paying cash for a deal, it's very simple math. I pay 70% of the after repair value minus the cost of repairs and acquisition. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. I don't break outside of that box. And if I do, it's because there's some sort of massive spread that hedges my risk. Mm-hmm. Somebody else sent me a deal. I won't say who, because I'm sure you know who they are. Sent me a deal this week that was, you know, a $70,000 potential profit, but it was on over $1 million investment. Mm. And they're like, I'm like, this, hey, it's not a deal for me. And it was $1 million into the deal. I'm like, it's not a deal for me. He's like, what do you mean? It's 70 grand in profit. And I'm like, yeah, but with $1 million risk associated to it, it doesn't work for me. So on a cash deal, it's just very simple math, 70% minus repair. And that's what I pay. Or better in a perfect world.
Perfect world.
And then on creative deals, I just look at it on effectively 2 fundamental calculations. One is cash on cash return, right? So for how much cash do I have to put into this deal versus how much am I going to make back in net cash flow, and how good are the terms for how long? I don't want to bog down your timeline, but the best story I can tell of this is a deal I bought up in a Placer, in West Reading. It was a gal who had a situation where her, partner had passed away. He had set a number that they had said that they would never sell the property unless they hit this number. Well, they had an appraisal for $75,000 less than that number. And he had passed away and she was just stuck. She's like, I'm not selling. I want out because I emotionally want mm-hmm. out, but I'm stuck on this number because I want to honor my partner. And I was like, great, I'll pay that. Like, I'll pay the $75,000 over. And she's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, here's how this works. It's price or terms. You don't owe anything on this property. You also told me that you don't have any need for cash because you were set up well. She got a big life insurance settlement. She's like, she didn't need the cash. She just needed out of the property. And right. I said, here's how it's going to work. I'm going to pay you $75,000 more than we know this thing's worth. Not even my opinion. The appraiser told us this.
Right.
But I'm going to get 0% interest for 15 years. Principal only payments. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to make any payments to you for the first year while I get the ADU fixed up and we get it worked out. And she's like, done.
Wow.
Like for her, it was like a no brainer because she's like, I get what I want.
She was fixated on the price.
It was the price. And so yeah. I went, great. As soon as I know what makes you motivated, my goal in a creative deal is to make it a deal is if I can get all of your likes, hopes, and wants out of the deal, my goal is actually to say yes to all of them. Mm-hmm. Because then when I provide you terms that make it make sense to me, why wouldn't you say yes? I've already given you everything you want. Win-win. Right. And so in a creative deal, it's a little harder to like
have a box.
Say, this is my buy box, but cash on cash returns really important. And like, we all know that, yeah, I paid $75,000 more in this property, but in 15 years, it's going to be worth double.
Right.
And I am going to save hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest on $600,000 of seller right. financing at 0% interest.
Yeah.
And so it was a win for her. It was a win for me. So that I don't know if that's a concise answer.
It's a concise and just real quick, because I have this really curiosity for seller financing. Typically it's for a set period of years. Sometimes it's longer, 15. Is there a snowball coming where you're going to have to like refinance or like, you know?
Yeah, we call them balloon payments.
Yeah.
So
I say a snowball because it's like with all like the creativity coming up to a year point that you're like, hey, I'm going to have to refinance into a traditional to pay off this? Like, is there?
I mean, I don't consider it a snowball because we manage
good snowball. Well, snow's good.
Snow's good. It's, you know, unless you're Dave Ramsey, but, a debt snowball, but, I don't see it as like a, cause when I hear snowball, it's like it's picking up speed and it's going to crash.
Yeah.
Because we manage all of our maturities on an annual basis anyway. So it's, I don't really see it as like something that's building that I'm going to have this big, like,
I have 20 properties now I have to refinance. Yeah.
So we manage it that way. But the other component of it is that on all the sub two stuff, I don't have maturity dates. Mm-hmm. So the maturity date is the date that it's paid off.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then if I have other types of maturity, like, so sometimes we do hybrid deals where there's like some equity in the property. Mm-hmm. So I buy it sub two and then I seller finance the equity. Those sometimes have balloon payments and maturity dates, but we just manage them as they come.
Right.
And so the biggest issue that I have with maturity dates on sub two is that I can't refinance them in many, well, I can, but I try not to refinance them because then I lose the rate that right. got me into the property to begin with.
Which made it the sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. so, but that, to me, and you know this, and any investor would say this, that the money is not made on the exit. The money's made on the entry. Mm-hmm. And so if I analyze all of these deals properly on the front end, then my back end is protected.
Right. Totally. Well, this has been a wealth of knowledge. I feel like we could be like part two, part three, part four. but if people wanted to connect with you, kind of like pick your brain even more. Dead Presidents Club is a free resource where people can jump in, kind of learn about money, managing.
Yeah. Investment. And I do free consults. Like Perfect. You literally can just get into the easiest way to get me is social media, the Just Dead Presidents. You can find me there, link to my social. But like, yeah, you can go on the website, I'll do an hour, sit down, and we don't charge for that. My goal is to help as many people win as possible. Cause yeah. I think that if I can help enough people win, it'll be really hard for me not to.
Yeah. Well, you found your exit out of banking, and now it's just like, hey, if I can give that legacy, your whole why from the very beginning, and I can create more legacy for other people to tap into that, it's like a win-win, and it's just, you know, financial freedom.
Well, and I just want to meet more friends like you that are doing awesome things. And it's like, yeah, not every interaction I have is like somebody who's going to really help my journey.
Yeah.
But like, I met you because I met Samia because I met, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, and it's just, there's this power of people. The way we always say it is nobody has a money problem. They have a people problem.
Yeah.
And so my goal is just to get as many awesome, like collect as many awesome people as possible.
I don't have doors. I have like 100 people.
I'm hoarding awesome people. And so like, and it's kind of funny, but it's true. I'm like yeah. I've texted you on stuff. Like, I'm like, hey, I want to know what Faith thinks about this property.
Right.
Like, because I'm not, I don't want to operate in a vacuum. Like, yeah. you know, I want And I'm the king of I know a guy or I know
yeah.
a girl.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be like that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I'll defer to her.
Yeah. Just hey, I don't know the answer to that, but I know someone. So yeah, don't worry. Yeah. The yeah. answer is always yes. I know a guy. You know,
so. Well, perfect. Well, I appreciate your wealth of knowledge, your creativity. I mean, this has been really awesome. Actually, I've not had a podcast yet just in this kind of space of creativity. So it's okay. cool for those listening just to kind of hear it in a different lens. Because again, you can do it a million ways, slice it a different way. And, you know, at the end of the day, figure out what your passion, purpose, and why you're doing what you're doing. So thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of the Hustle Podcast. And it was great having you on.
Thanks for having me.